Okay, everybody, we're going to get going. We'll take our seats. I'm going to once again ring the singing bowl. I'll be quiet just for a minute, and then we're going to continue on with our next session. Spirit of the happy, joyous, and free, thank you for this place, for this retreat, for this group of people that we're recognizing you and our ability to recognize you as our one and only guide in this process. We'd ask that you would guide our thoughts, our actions, and our words, that we be blessed, that our hearts be filled, and that love overflow from us into the lives of all of those people that we will help. Amen. I want to talk a little bit about our 11th step. When I'm going through the step work, I'm really clear that we're starting in the beginning and we're moving along. This retreat is not a linear. It's just not the feeling I'm getting this weekend to do a linear path through the steps. So we're bouncing around a little bit, but the 11th step is one of those steps that I will as soon as I see that somebody is interested in the spiritual life and we're going through the work, and I love that this group is a group that is solid in the circle and triangle. The unity, service, and recovery. The three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the same as what we read on page 55 with this attitude, you cannot fail. That symbol, the AA symbol, and the three legacies of AA describe the same thing, that if you're in the unity side of the triangle, and which is the home group and the 12 traditions, and if you're a member, so that's why they tell you, get a home group, get some unity, that we have this common problem that with other people, that's important to us. Now our book tells us that would never hold us together as we're now joined. The thing is that we have a common solution, a way out which we absolutely agree on. And so I don't know if you've been to your group's business meeting lately, but sometimes it's hard to figure out what is it that we absolutely agree on here. And I think that was best captured in the 12 and 12, in the forward to the 12 steps and 12 traditions. It says that the 12 steps are the 12 steps are spiritual in their nature, and that when practiced as a way of life, they expel the obsession to drink and render the alcoholic happily and usefully whole. I think that's what we agree on. We agree that completely that the 12 steps are spiritual in nature, and that when you apply that way of life to this problem of alcoholism, that we can be happily and usefully whole. That so as soon as somebody is showing signs, people will often, the new guys will come and say, we're going through the steps. And when I go through the steps, it takes some time. We're going to be in the steps for a while. I'm not a guy, although I'm very, very close with several groups and people I love, and one person in particular that I know that's absolutely a fabulous AA, lives in Lafayette, Louisiana. I've been down to his place and done retreats for his group, and he is really big. I mean, he takes guys through the steps in one weekend. He and his wife both of them, they go through all of the steps in one weekend. It's just their deal. That's their, and I'm not here to say that my way is any more effective or that it's any, but it just is a good way. I know that. It's a good way. And it's going to take some time when we're going through the steps. And oftentimes, the new person will come and say, there's got to be something more. There's got to be something. You know, I need something. What can you give me? And I'll give them some outside literature, different things. But really, what I try to do is get them to start practicing step 11. It's the one step, I think, that really you can take whenever the person is ready to sit them down and say, okay, well, if you're really wanting more, here's something you can do upon awakening when we retire at night and as we go through the day. Here's the things that you do. So start doing your 11th step when you retire at night. Upon awakening, take a few minutes to do that. Do some prayer and meditation. Stop and remind yourself that you're no longer running the show during the day. That in the 10th step, the words that they use are inspiration, intuitive thought, the ability to make a decision, this inspiration that we have. And I was so lucky to get sober with guys that had that just knew, that were inspired, like the guys that picked me up at that very first meeting and asked me if I wanted to go to detox. There was a detox that was 10 minutes from that hall. But they knew that if they drove me 10 minutes that I would be down the road. So they took me up to Everett, Washington, which is not far from Seattle. I mean, it's a very easy drive. But for a guy that was in the condition that I was in, Everett, you might as well have taken me down here and taken me out to the Mojave Desert and dropped me off, because I was there. I just didn't have the game to fight to get my clothes back once they had me in the pajamas, and I'd been through that before to try to do all that. They knew that. They were intuitively inspired to do those things. That the inspiration, the intuitive thought, the decision, this state of mind that we have comes naturally. It's the thing that, like, we can come to rely on it. Like somebody calls, or somebody comes to mind, you think, I'm going to call that person today. And you call and they say, man, I was just thinking about you. And that we decide, well, I don't think I'm going to go to that Tuesday. I think I'm going to go to the other meeting instead. And you go over there and there's somebody that is like, man, where have you been? I've been looking for you and I've been trying to get in touch with you. And it just, the life just works that way. There's a this word coincidence, right? This is my understanding of that word is that this coincidence is a mathematical term, and it really describes these intersecting angles that happen in real complex mathematics. And they will say, well, that's a coincidence. These two angles coincide. It's a coincidence. But in mathematics, there are no chance events. And I think that's the way it is in the spiritual life as well, when you're living it. I got helped early in sobriety. There was a guy that was in the meetings, and he was, every time they called on him, he would talk about the spiritual life and talk about his prayer and his meditation. I was maybe a month sober, and I was going completely out of my mind. I was going back to the car lot at night, and I would just be, I would go sober. I was going days without sleeping, like 4 or 5 days with no sleep, sober, and going to these meetings. And there was like a dish rag just like in my guts. And I was like a panic attack, but it wasn't an attack. It was just panic, you know, just, it never subsided. And finally, my body would get exhausted enough to where I would fall asleep. And so I went up to this guy that I would always see. Every time they called on him, he would have something really profound to say about. And I thought, well, maybe this guy, just like Arne did for us this morning, and, you know, gently walked us. I just went up to him, and his name was also by coincidence. His name was Ken as well. And I went up and I said, listen, I'm having some problems, and I think I'm probably going to start drinking. But I'm hoping that maybe this prayer and meditation that you talk, maybe it can calm me down a little bit. And so, what is it that you do? And how do you do that? And he said, "Well, sit down." He taught me. He just said, "Just find your seat. You know, just find your seat." Which is just, he wasn't a big guy on having to be exactly perfect or, you know, to hold your hands a certain way. He just said, find a seat where it's comfortable for you. You know, being a Westerner, you know, it's nice to have a back on your chair for me. So I like to be in a chair when I'm doing my meditation. But if you're not a Westerner, it's probably more comfortable that you do something different. So he said, find your seat. And then he said, start concentrating on your breath. Just breathe in and out, in and out. And he said, then introduce some kind of a mantra. And he said, you know, I like thy will be done. He said, so just start repeating to yourself, watch your breath. And then when you're able to watch your breath, then repeat thy will be done. And he said, you can even shorten that up, and you can just shorten it up to thy will. And he said, if you really want to, you can just start shortening it up to just the word thy, just thy, and breathe and do your meditation. And that was the first introduction that I had to meditation. And I don't think I probably was a complete month sober when I met and talked with him. And then I would notice that I didn't see him for long periods of time. And I'd asked him, well, hey, where were you? And he told me, I was meditating. And I haven't seen you in a couple of weeks. He says, yeah, I meditated for 10 days without stop, straight. And I thought, oh my God, I've asked a complete nutcase to. And he told me that when he meditated, he could walk through walls. And that he used to have to go to India to see his guru. But now he just meditates, and he goes into a place where he meditates for long enough that he and his guru can work with each other back and forth, and he can ask and receive questions, and his guru is right there with him without ever leaving his house. Doesn't have to travel to India anymore. And he told me when he walks after meditating for that long that his feet don't touch the ground, that he can walk across the road and is without his feet touching the ground. And so then I'm thinking, oh boy, you know, what have I run into here? And I kind of thought, and he was an older guy, and he passed away when I was 5 years sober. So then I thought, well, I think that I've kind of got some advice from a guy who was a little bit nutty. And then with this open-mindedness that I talked about, you know, the truth is that I've never meditated for 10 days straight without stopping. So I don't know what happens when you meditate for 10 days. And that's been so comforting to me to not to have the truth. You know, one of the things that DeMello says is he says that in the spiritual life, the I don't know is in a lot of times that is home. That it, the I don't know is better than an endless search for the truth that in the end is not going to be satisfactory. That I can go on that path. So I don't know what was going on with my friend in early sobriety. I don't know, but I'll tell you one thing. I'm definitely at a place where I'm not going to say that he wasn't visiting with his guru, that he wasn't passing through walls, and that he couldn't walk and his feet didn't touch the ground. Because I've never committed myself to that level that he had found a place to do. The first, and you know, this stuff starts out simply. The first third step that I ever did, I was at the car lot, and my sponsor Al, who I talked to yesterday morning, before I came up here, before I do any talks or anything, I always call Al and see how he's doing. He's been a bit of a Rolling Stone traveling guy. He's elderly now, and he's had some health issues. So I like to check up on him. When he drove me to detox that night and I met him for the first time, he'd never worked a step. I don't think he'd ever worked, and he wouldn't mind me saying this. I think he would agree with that he'd never worked a step at all. And he was 13 years sober. But he was absolutely the perfect guy for me. What he was an expert at giving. He knew that somehow by giving, he would find. And so he would look for the face of hopelessness in AA meetings, and he still does this today, and he makes the approach as a person that's found an answer. Now, he's the fact that he's had from 13 to 46 years of sobriety, you know, 46, 47 years of sobriety now that he has, he's changed as much in that 33 years as I have from zero to 33. He's a totally, totally different person than he was then. I saw my sponsor Al get in two fights in my first year of sobriety when I was at the car lot. Both of them over the same thing. Customers coming back, bringing cars back and saying, hey, I want my money back. And you know, in his condition at that time of his life, he didn't care for that very much. And because people, he would say, hey, what do you expect? You know, I sold that car for $700 and you know, it was not a new car and now it needs brakes and that's not my problem. And he would handle it much differently today. He's a way different person. And some of us at the break talked about just, you know, like we are people who have to find a way to calm down or else. In AA, 33 years sober, I have to continue to find a way to calm down or else. So I was at the hall and I heard people talking about steps, and there was a fellow there that I was still sober a couple of months. I was still shoplifting at there was a little place called the Hoagie's Corner. I would go up there, and if the heat was on or they were watching me too closely, but I would always buy something. I had a little money. Al would always make sure I didn't get on the wrong side of a $20 bill, but he would have me do a couple hours work in the morning, and I was like $5 an hour, $6 an hour. And of course, I'm thinking in my head, I'm thinking, well, what this guy's got going is he's a guy that preys on, this is a guy that drove me to detox, picked me up from detox, gave me a place to live, gave me my first sober job, put a roof over my head, woke me up every morning, brought me breakfast every morning, bought me coffee every morning, talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous every morning. And in my head, I'm thinking, I know what his game is. his game is, I've been a chief engineer on these fishing boats, making a lot of money and running the whole thing and being people's bosses. And this guy expects me to work down at this car lot. He's preying on these people that have fallen down on their luck, and he's preying on them so that they'll come down to his car lot and he can get them to work for $5 an hour. So I would put a couple hours work in begrudgingly and in my mind going through this, knowing that I can't say anything to Al because he's a pretty gruff guy and I'm not going to say anything to him. But that's what was going through my mind. And I'd go up to the hall and I was just lost, and I would do this shoplifting. I'd boost a pack of cigarettes. They used to have cigarettes, you know, where they would have the generic cigarettes. Sometimes it'd be right on the counter or something. So I'd buy a couple things and palm a pack of cigarettes, and I was pretty good at it. And I went and made my amends to Hoagie's Corner, and I went to make my amends to the Bartell Drugstore, which were the two stores I was doing that. Once I got to a place, but this guy, I was doing that. You could smoke in the meeting in those days, and Jimmy R was coming into the meetings, and he was his sponsor was a Catholic priest. Yeah, that lived in Seattle, and this Catholic priest sponsored quite a few guys, but he was a very hardcore 12-step AA guy. So Jimmy was out making his amends, and he was coming back to the hall every day saying, I went to 5 stores today that I shoplifted from, and I made my amends, and things were going great for Jimmy, and he seemed happy, and then he'd come back. Yeah, I went to 2 old girlfriends and flew to this place, and I made my amends, I did this stuff, And I'm sitting there smoking these stolen cigarettes, lighting, and it make me so goddamn nervous I'd have to light one stolen cigarette right off the other, you know, to just, and he's talking. So I went down to Al and I said, Al, I think we're supposed to be working some steps here. And he said, well, what step do you think you're on? And I said, and this is the blind leading the blind. And he says, what step do you think you're on? And I said, well, I think I'm on step 3. I just had read the steps on the wall. I think I'm on step 3. And he said, okay, well, let's see. He got his 12 and 12 out. We went out on the car lot. We set down 2 folding little lawn chairs on the car lot. And we read step 3 out of the 12 and 12. And at the end of that, we said the serenity prayer. And that was it, you know, and so I went back to my little room after we'd done that. We closed up the car lot for the night, and I'm sitting there, like, we're sitting there on these folding chairs, and Highway 99 is right there, like, massive traffic going by, and, you know, all kinds of stuff happening and in the neighborhood, and we closed the car lot down. I go back to my little room at the car lot, and I laid down on my bed, and this peace, like, came over me, like, just this incredible peaceful feeling like I'd never felt before in my life. Just this overwhelming sense of peace and calm. And I was so tired because I'd been staying up over, you know, overnight and barely sleeping. And probably some of that had to do with the amount of, you know, coffee and lattes and sugar I was eating and, you know, all the rest of that madness. And I was so peaceful that I didn't want to fall asleep. I remember thinking, God, don't go to sleep, don't go to sleep. I just want to sit here and feel this feeling, whatever this is. I just want to feel that feeling. And then I knew, intuitively, I had this sense that I was going to be okay. And then I had the feeling like, I'm not going to be okay. I'm okay right now. That I knew somehow in that moment. And it's just such a simple thing because neither one of us knew what we were doing. And a few days after that, I was completely out of my mind. And I down, and thank God, I don't know how come Al didn't throw me out, but, you know, many times with stuff that I did. I shot a bottle rocket one time and it got stuck in the little gutter and it burned a big chunk of the roof off and the fire department had to come. And this happened at the car lot, and Al, we've got it fixed up, and you know it. And but I came back and I left my keys somehow. I'd locked my keys away, and my temper just blew up. And this was like a day or two after I just had all this peace. I was completely out of my mind, and I was just pounding. And I finally kicked the door in, the back door that would let me into my little place, and the door, you know, shattered. And I went in, and a couple people at the hall had given me, a lady had given me a television set, so I had a little TV to watch, and somebody else had given me a couple things, and I smashed that television. And I had kicked the door in, and then I knew Al's going to come in the morning. He's going to see the door. He's going to see this. He's going to throw me out, which none of that happened. You know, he came and was like, boy, what the hell happened to you last night? You know, are you okay? And then he made me fix the door, and he made me clean up all the stuff. And so I went to the hall after that, and Jimmy was there. And I told Jimmy, I said, man, I did my third step, and I'm trying to kind of, and he said, well, what would you do after three? Because it says that this is going to have, you might have this big experience, but you're going to have little permanent effect unless at once. And he got the book out and he showed me that. And I'd never seen anything like that. I was just like, wow, that's why this happened, because I didn't do this other work. And he told me about this big book workshop that he and a couple guys were going to be going to. And he said, you got to come down and go to this deal with us. And that's how I got introduced to the steps. But all of this stuff, led me to where I was. And I can tell you the experience that I've had with Al over all these years and watching him grow. And there was a time Al called me. I was working, and I had a nice office and a nice job and stuff. And he was still going up to Alaska, and he was working on barges up there. The car lot business didn't work out. And part of the reason it didn't work out, I think, is because he was taking all the money he had, making it the car lot, and giving it to people like me. I really believe that. That was just a place that was meant for that time and that space. And I was coming, and several of the other guys that he sponsored would come to the car lot, and he would talk about AA. And once in a while, somebody would come and buy a car. There was just this magical time and place. But Al called me. I was well into my sobriety. I don't know how long I was sober, maybe 20 years or something. And Al calls me and says, hey, do you think we can get together for lunch? And I says, oh man, Al, I'd love that more than anything. So he comes down, we go to lunch, and he starts telling me that he's having trouble trying to figure out, he doesn't want to be dishonest, and he's having trouble figuring out how to get out of this work that he's doing, because his body is breaking down. He's on these frozen barges up in Alaska, steel barges walking, and his feet are hurting, and his knees are hurting, and his back is hurting, and he doesn't want to make a medical claim because he's kind of thinking, I can still do it, but it's just not good for me anymore, and I don't want to make a medical claim, and I don't want to be dishonest about this, and I just want to try to, and he's coming to me, and I had that sweetness in that moment of realizing, like, this guy is asking me for my opinion on stuff. That the relationship was a shoulder-to-shoulder relationship. That he had thought of me to come ask about this problem that he had. And he had a really bad accident on the barge not too long after that. And he was able to stop working, and he had a heart attack as a result of some of the stuff that happened on this accident, and they flew him to Anchorage. And I'm just going to tell you this story just so you can get a feeling for the kind of people that we get to have in our lives here in AA. You know, you'll run into these people, man. All you got to do is just open your eyes and search for them. They're all around. His ex-wife called me and said, hey, Al had a problem and he's had a heart attack. He's on his way to the hospital. They're going to get him down here to Seattle. They're going to have to do open heart surgery and fix him up and do some other stuff. They got him only as far as Anchorage, Alaska, and they said, you're not going to make it. They had to do the surgery there in Anchorage. And just by coincidence, I knew a lot of people in Anchorage, and I thought, God, this is my chance to give back to Al. So I start calling all of my AA Anchorage contacts and telling them, hey, this guy's in the hospital. We're going to arrange for an AA meeting for him. We're going to have a bunch of people show up, and I'm going to bring Al an AA meeting, and I'm going to arrange this whole thing. Of course, I didn't ask Al about it. And Al says, I call him up and I tell him, Al, you're going to love this. I got a bunch of people that are going to bring an AA meeting to you in your room there and stuff. And he says, yeah, I'm not really into that. And he says, you know what, Kenny? This is a guy laying in his hospital bed. He says, you know what, Kenny? I got my AA literature with me. That's one of the first things I grabbed to bring with me. They flew me out on the medevac and stuff. I've got my big book, my 12 and 12 here. He says, my phone is ringing off the hook. I got everything I need. But if you know somebody that needs some help, why don't you send them on up here? And I did. I knew a young kid in Anchorage that was struggling. And I called him. This guy Keegan, I called him and I said, hey, why don't you go up? And he went up and Al wrapped him up and just sat him down and talked to him about Alcoholics Anonymous and got him, you know, set on his feet. So let's do a few more questions and answers. We're gonna go till a little after 11 here and then we'll take a break and then we're gonna come back just for another short session. I'm gonna give some instructions, and then we're going to be taking our longer break for the day. So, with that, I think the ask it basket is back there. So, do you have fighting fantasies in your head? I'm pretty sure that's what it says. Do you have fighting fantasies in your head? So, I don't now, but I think I know what this question is asking about, you know, these fantasies of all kinds that somehow maybe, I don't know if that's what the question is. If the person that asked this question would like to clarify, we've got the mic ready, is that right? And or if somebody else, but that somehow will be the hero, or that something is going to happen, or that somehow I'm going to tackle some big problem, or I'm going to be the big guy, or that I'm going to be and I know what that's like. I've had many of those kind of fantasies, whether it's a fantasy of fighting or a fantasy of having a lot of money or a lot of prestige or a lot of all of these things that will tell me that I'm okay, because I'm a guy that the reason that I think I was had some success in the seafood and fishing business is because I was, even when I was on the boats prior to getting sober, I would always, if we were going to work 20 hours a day and only sleep for four, I would work an extra hour. I would be out on deck chaining everything down and making sure that nothing was going to shift and cleaning up and tidying up the deck, and then I would go down. And I had to do that. I think, you know, it wasn't a healthy thing. It wasn't like I was some of the results were okay because I was able to get, you know, far in my career because, not because I had any kind of education, because I'm the least educated. I have a great deal of fun with this because we talked about this at breakfast a little bit that, you know, the intellect is not our friend here. Emmett Fox says it's like putting a thermometer in your mouth to try to see how much you weigh. Nothing wrong with the tool. The tool's fine. The thermometer is going to tell you what your temp, but it's not going to help you if you want to know how much you weigh. It's the wrong tool for the job. You can go stand on a scale, and it's not going to tell you what your temperature is. They probably got scales now that do that, but the you know, the intellect is not your friend. And I've had so much fun because I've been able to, I've sponsored doctors, I've sponsored lawyers, I've sponsored PhD, college professors, and they all come with this idea that somehow all of this knowledge they have is going to help them out. And to be able to just be a witness to people dropping that and realizing that, man, it has to come from the heart. That so I said we were going to answer a couple questions, which we'll do. So on this, fantasies, yes. And so if you're willing to share, what are some areas in your life you found difficult to completely let go and trust God? So I would say there's a couple of areas that I found difficult. And we talked to a couple folks here just at the breaks and lunch that one of the areas, one of the things that somebody asked me about this haunted me well into my sobriety was this anger piece. And it was so embarrassing because I had a situation where I would, and this is just an isolated, but I went down to mow the lawn at the house and my lawnmower wouldn't start. And I pulled and pulled and pulled on it, and I checked the spark plug and I checked the gas, and I pulled and pulled and pulled and pulled, and I was just sweaty and I was a mess. And then I just took a rake, a big, heavy, thick rake like you'd rake out gravel, and I just beat that lawnmower to a pulp and just destroyed this thing, just absolutely destroyed the lawnmower. And I was yelling, and I'm sure the neighbors heard me, and I came back in the house, and the house was totally silent, like just dead silent. My son was there, my daughter was there, my wife was there. And I came back in the house, and I just was like, and I just said, oh, I said to my wife, you guys heard that, huh? She was like, oh, yeah, man. Oh, yeah, we heard it all right. And so that's one of them. Like, the anger, for some reason, dogged me, like, well into my sobriety. One of the other things is that in sobriety, I had to seek some outside help. And I was, earlier in my sobriety, I've been married for 25 years to the same woman. This was before I got married. But actually, when we were first together, I had to tell her about this fact that I'm seeing a therapist. And I had sexual behavior that was just completely not in alignment with a spiritual way of life, and yet I was talking about the spiritual life in the program. I was talking about things. I was, you know, people would call on me, and I would be expected that I would say some really great things about the program of AA. That's why they'd call on me, so I didn't want to let anybody down, so I would just say these things, and it was just this secret in my life. And I finally went to a magazine that's kind of known in the Seattle area. You get this magazine, but it has all kinds of stuff in there. If you wanted to find a prostitute, you could find prostitute in there, and you could find drugs, you could find drugs in there, and you know, you find about anything you want. But I went there and I looked in this little section, and there was somebody that ran an ad for sexual therapy. And I called the number. And I went and saw this lady, and she said, well, tell me a little bit about your background. Tell me about your childhood. Tell me about some of the early experiences that you had. Tell me about what you learned about that. And I learned that, you know, in many ways, that was something I started doing as a very young man, to nurture myself, because my house was insane. You know, I was afraid to come out of my bedroom. I used to walk up and down that same Highway 99. I used to walk up and down that Highway 99 all night long as a kid. I was homeless as a kid, a lot longer than I was homeless as an adult before I got sober. And I would walk up and down Highway 99, and I would hitchhike to get out of the rain. And, you know, when you do that in the middle of the night in a bad neighborhood like that, where this kind of stuff, some bad stuff happens. And I would do that, and I would in my mind, I was 11 or 12 years old, and I was hitchhiking. And that was a better option than going to the home where I had a bedroom. So, you know, I told this lady a little bit about some of that stuff. And she said, Kenny, this is gonna take... I just heard a little buzz on, like, a little fly. I don't want to be the... Who was it that had the fly that landed on their head and that... Pence. I don't want to be like Pence up here with my gray hair and this bug landing on me and not knowing it. And she just said... I talked to this lady for about 15 minutes, and she said, I'm not going to see you unless you will agree to come every week for 2 years. Because that's how long it's going to take. You've got some wires crossed, and it's going to take a couple years for us to uncross those wires. And I went and saw that lady for 2 years, and that's during that period of times when I met my wife, and I was able to have, you know, this first successful, loving, true partnership with another human being. 12 and 12 says we're completely unable to have a true partnership with another human being. And the book also says that we don't ever not reveal ourselves, reveal something about ourselves that can be helpful to another human being. Now this, I've told that story so many times, and you cannot believe the number of people that have come up to me and said, can you tell me a little more about that? Do you have that lady's number? Do you have this? And she's now, I just recently, the last time that I sent somebody to, I said, you can go see the two-year lady. Man, that's probably what it's going to take. And here's her number. But she's now, it's been a long time, and she's retiring, so I'm going to need to find another two-year person to give people's phone numbers to. And I will say, and I know we'll wrap it up with this, and we'll get back to some more of these questions, and thanks for the people that are writing them, but I've received some of the worst advice that you could possibly imagine around sex in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I've received some horrible advice from people that said, well, geez, you know, I'd tell them about this problem I was having, and they'd say, geez, what was that like? Like they were interested in the details, you know. I'm like, okay. I think I've sought out and these are people that I had respect for and admiration and just, but they just were not the right people. So there's some things that I've struggled with in AA, and I continue. But I can tell you that sine curve that we talked about with anger. I don't know that I'm completely free of anger, but it has been a long time. I've calmed down a lot. I still got a long, long ways to go. I mean, I just consider myself a piker here, a student, but I've seen it in other people, so I know it's possible. I've seen people that have, and it's been a long time since I've taken a rake to anything, so there we go. All right, man, we'll come back. We'll come back at 11:20, and we'll do one more session, quick session, before lunch. Then we're going to have a long break after lunch.
Hey, guys.